So thank you very much for inviting me here today. I'm going to talk about some research I started as a PhD student at UCL in the Resilience Project, and now I'm continuing at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine as part of the MRC Skills Fellowship. So just an overview of the things I'm going to talk about today. A quick overview about like history theory, cooperative breeding, and parental investment. And then I'll move on to talk about three studies, which are all related in one way or another, in the way that I find them all interesting. So we do quantity-quality trade-offs and demographic change in the ACTA, then looking at social networks, fitness, and what implications this has to do with cooperation. And finally, looking at sex bias parental investment, which is actually the first time I've presented on the sex bias parental investment. So actually, it's something new, which is exciting. So a bit of theory. Parental investment, for sake of this, I'll be talking about it in terms of any activity which benefits one individual offspring. And because resources are finite, this energy which is put into one child can't be reinvested into other children. And it's a really important concept which has implications for child health and well-being. In terms of that, you'd assume that if you're going to put energy invested into a child, it's going to have a positive influence in some form of outcome. Particularly, we can see that parents are the gatekeepers through which development or public health interventions may work. So if we take an instance of food aid, an NGO might go, see that there's a needy child, and be like, you know, here are some resources to give to your child. But the parent, if the mother in particular, will be the one to decide whether that actually goes to that child or it goes equally to all the children. And understanding why there's variability in these characteristics is really important. And that's really the aim of my future research, is taking quite well-developed concepts in evolutionary anthropology about understanding variation in parental investment and working with them in a way that they could actually be applied more usefully. Parental investment is really linked up with like history theory. The energy is finite in the environment because time is finite. And because of that, you have to allocate resources to the competing demands of maintenance, growth, and reproduction. And here's a really simplistic figure demonstrating how these trade-offs may occur. So individuals who spend a long time in growth are going to be really high quality. And as a result, they may have high-quality offspring. But because they spend so long in growth, they have a much shorter period of reproduction. So that means they get to reproducing later, and they don't have so long to have many children. In contrast, you've got an individual who spends less time in growth. They are going to be of lower quality. However, they have a much earlier point of first reproduction, and then they have longer time in which they can actually reproduce in. So whilst they're having significantly more children, these children will be of lower quality. And here I'm not really defining quality other than the sense that they may be of lower birth weight, for instance, lower BMI, any way you can conceive of it. This is just the defining the quantity-quality trade-off. And then the optimal solution for this classic trade-off is that, you know, it's dependent completely on the environment. So the time you have available to you, and thus the energy you have to work with, is curtailed by death. And there's some form of death which there's nothing you can do about. This is the concept of extrinsic mortality or extrinsic risk. For instance, there's some form of virulent viral diseases, especially without medical Western medical services, which if your child has, you know, you may not be able to make sure they survive, or you have accidents, violence, things like this. And why it's important is because no matter if you think your child is going to die, regardless of what energy you put into them, it may actually at that point be more sensible to withdraw your investment and refocus your investment in other offspring, either the current ones you have or future ones. The idea, quite simply, is that you will have a lot of children to make sure at least a few of them survive, rather than having two very high quality children, and regardless of their quality, they'll die anyway. And this has profound implications for both behaviour and demography, and I think a really good example of this are changes that we see during the Neolithic Revolution, so switching tracks a little bit. So about 13,000 to 10,000 years ago, we saw the advent of agriculture for the first time, and this is associated with significant increases in morbidity and mortality because of the first epidemiological transition. So When mobile hunter and gatherers settle for the first time, they increase their densities, they come into contact with other populations more, and they are living in environments which may not have a lot of sanitation. And so what we see is that because of this, this really facilitates the transmission of a number of different diseases. Measles, for instance, need populations of over 500,000 to survive, because it's very acute and it can often kill the host before it's able to transmit the disease on. So what we find is with sedentarization and bigger population densities, the advent of domestication, increasing the incidence of zoonotic diseases, so that's diseases which pass over the species barrier and often are more acute because not yet evolved to a human host. And also food stores for the first time with agriculture attracting rodents means there is suddenly a higher incidence of disease. And this has led in bioarchaeology to the question of why do we see previously healthy foragers settle for the first time and become unhealthy farmers? Simplifying it a bit, but what we see is that one gain is demonstrated in the first demographic transition, which happened in the late Paleolithic. So if we look at foragers who settle today, this is a study from Bentley and colleagues back in 1993, I think, and they looked at the average total fertility rate of foragers compared to agriculturalists, and they found that agriculturalists had about 18.2% higher total fertility rate as compared to the foragers and horticulturalists. Likewise, if we looked at the early Neolithic, we see there's about a 40 times increase during the early Neolithic compared to the late Paleolithic in population growth, indicating that fertility during this time period is significantly increasing. So looking at this information, particularly from a Darwinian point of view, could argue that maybe individuals are facing a higher burden of ill health because ultimately there's something about agriculture and sedentarization which is increasing fertility. And this is exactly the question that I wanted to explore with the AGTA as one of the main parts of my PhD, and seeing if we can understand this process of sedentarization as a quantity-quality trade-off. To explore this question, we can break it down into three separate parts. Firstly, is morbidity and mortality increased in the most permanent camps? And this is the idea that if diseases are a measure of extrinsic risk, the big if, but we'll get to that, then perhaps we can, being sedentarized may be increasing extrinsic risk. The second point is there an increased child quantity? So do you see women having more children in the more permanent camps? And finally, can we say this is adaptive in one way or another? So are women who are living in those permanent camps having more children, surviving to the age 16? So to give you some context about the AGTA, they're a hunter and gatherer group from the Philippines. So it's quite actually a small picture down here. They live in Luzon, which is the biggest, most northerly island of the Philippines, and the northeastern area, a place called Palanan. It's the Philippines has a lot of indigenous populations. Some of them are farmers, and some of them are hunter and gatherers. And there's been for a long time a lot of interaction between these populations. So they are in no way isolated. But what is interesting about Palanan is that it's completely within a national park, which is denoted by that border and the bigger map there. And, to get into that national park, you have to hike 3 days over a mountainous tropical forest terrain, or it's about a day's journey by boat, or a rather expensive aircraft ride over the mountains, which is also dependent on the weather. So the population of Palanan is much smaller than other parts of the Philippines, and it feels much more, it has a small town vibe than other places of the Philippines. It's much less developed. Now, the AGTA, there's about 1,000 within the population. We met about 950 of them during our research. They primarily are fisher foragers. Only about 3% of their activity is spent in hunting. And that's because a lot of them live on the coast or they live inland on the rivers. They're also highly mobile and cooperative, but there is significant variation in this. And this researcher says a product of 2 years, 1 year's research over a 2 year period. So this is just a close-up of the map of Palanan. We went to 14 different camps. Each of them are illustrated by the points on the map. You can see some of them up here are coastal and down here, and then some of them are closer to the market towns in Palanan, and they're inland, and then some of them are further away and getting into the more mountainous terrain. And so the ones that reside on the river are primarily fishers, and then these ones are using marine sources. But the actors don't really differ in terms of foraging ecology, but also in terms of sedentarization and market integration. So here, this is a coastal camp, and you see on the picture there's a number of lean-tos. We went to this camp about three or four times over the two-year period, and the people who lived in the camps were constantly changing. They'd come in and out. It was very fluid. And also the housing structures were changed. They are lean-tos, so you literally make them in a couple of hours out of a rattan, and you can pick them up and move them up and down the beach. So if you say, you know, why did you move your lean-to? They'd be like, it's smelly, it's dirty, I didn't have my neighbours. So it's very flexible. In contrast, this is an inland camp. This is a wooden hut, so it's not so clear on this picture, with a metal ceiling. This camp didn't change at all while we were there, and it had the same people living in it. So it's much closer to what you'd call to be a village. And also behind here, you have, this is a rice paddy, which the actor were cultivating. So there's significant differences in their engagement of cultivation and degree of sedentarization. And I wanted to make the most of this variation to explore how that would affect both health outcomes and fertility. So to do this, we use these HumaQ devices, which do on-the-spot blood composition analysis for red blood cells and five-part white blood cell differential. And this is really useful because this kind of research is really hard in very remote areas, because it's very hard to keep samples pristine and get them back in a lab in time if you don't know if a boat's going to come pick you up for one day or 10 days. So what you do is you just prick the finger, as demonstrated here, and it gets sucked into the cuvette, and then you put it into the machine, and within 30 seconds or a couple of minutes, depending on the test, you'll have a white blood cell differential. And we also did BMI and some standard anthropometrics. And what's interesting about the blood cell, white blood cell count is, like, depending on the main immune, the main disease that your body is currently fighting, one of the five different white blood cells will be increased. And here we're going to focus on lymphocytes, which are high when you have a viral disorder, and eosinophils, which are a very good measure of a parasitic burden, such as whipworm, roundworm, tapeworm, hookworm, all of the worms. And basically, when a worm invades the tissue of your body starts producing these eosinophils. And you find that generally they're very low in Western populations, and sadly quite much more high in populations around the world, particularly in hunter and gatherers. So we also, to get a sense of fertility, mortality, and survivorship at age 16, we also did reproductive histories with 117 mothers. Okay, so we use this data to answer the first question: does morbidity and mortality increase in the most permanent camps? So on this plot here, we have on the y-axis the mean eosinophil concentration. So anything above one in a child is abnormal. It would be indicative of a parasitic infection. And as you can see, everyone is pretty high, and about 85% of the population has abnormally high eosinophil loads. But this was variable according to degree of sedentarization. So, and just to explain, on the x-axis, we have camp type. So temporary camp is the lean-tos. I showed you the picture of earlier. A permanent camp would be the wooden part with the metal roof. And then semi-permanent is because there's some camps which have a mix of these features. Like, people are coming and going, kind of. There's some permanent houses and some lean-tos or more temporary structures. And we see, compared to the most temporary houses, semi-permanent ones had a 0.5 increase in eosinophil load. And the most permanent ones, compared to temporary ones, had a 0.61. What's also really interesting was we had values as high as 5. So like I said, anything above 1 is high, so 5 is just ridiculous, and is indicative of a very heavy polyparasitic burden. And these are only found in children in the most largest, most permanent camps. So it's a very good correlation between degree of sedentarization and eosinophil level. And this really makes sense because these parasites are passed through the fecal-oral route. So especially children will go to the toilet quite frequently just around the camp. And then there's larva or eggs on the floor, and it's easily transmitted, and these life cycles continue. And so it's being repeatedly, if you move away, and mobility really breaks up these burdens because you get to move away and break that life cycle. But if you're staying in the same place, you're just getting reinfected and reinfected. We're now looking at the viral load. So this plot is by camp. So we've got 14 points, and then we've got the proportion of individuals in each camp who've reported to have lymphocytosis. And that's when your viral load is so high, a doctor will say you have a viral disease. And then on the x-axis, we have to the your left, you have more mobile camps, and to the right, more sedentarized camps. And we can see from this plot, there's a nice correlation between these variables. And so the individuals with the lowest mobility had a 2.8 times higher risk of presenting with lymphocytosis than those living in the most permanent camps. So from this, we argue that there does seem to be an increase in morbidity. So they're experiencing more viral and parasitic diseases. So moving on, is this associated with increased mortality in childhood? So this is because we are unsure about our adult, the reporting for adult mortality is quite wishy-washy, people get really vague, but mothers tend to report childhood mortality with much more certainty. That's why we've just looked at the ages between 0 to 16, so pre-adult. And what we see is that women in the most permanent camps compared to the most temporary camps had a 63.2% increase in the mean mortality proportion, so the proportion of her children she reported to die out of all that were born. And this is compared to the most temporary camps, breaking down into our three variables as we had in the previous graph. So I would argue that this demonstrates there is a significant increase in viral and parasitic diseases in the most permanent camps. And this is also correlated with increases in mortality. So if we see that intrinsic risk or our measures of extrinsic risk are increased, do we see increases with child quantity? So what's happening to fertility rates? They actually have a very high total fertility rate of 7.7, which is one of the highest reported in small-scale societies and similar to the ACTA. But we see this significantly varies with sedentarization. So this this wasn't a longitudinal study, so a lot of the women we were interviewing obviously hadn't finished their reproductive lifespans yet, so we had to control for the fact that older women tend to have more children. So on this graph here, we have age-specific residuals. So if you have a positive bar, it means you have a higher than average fertility given your age, and if you have a negative bar, you have lower than fertility given your age. And if we just pay attention to the blue and the yellow and the blue bars here. The yellow bar is the nomadic women, and those are women that frequently moved in and out of camps, which were very temporary, and had those temporary housing. And compared these to the most sedentary women, so these women that never moved and lived in the biggest, most permanent camps, they had a 20.5% increase in age-controlled fertility. And so you can see that is significantly large. But of course, that's got to be contrasted against the fact that they had significantly higher mortality rates. So ultimately, if you have higher fertility, but you have high mortality, are these being cancelled out? So we looked at survivorship to age 16, which is our best proxy for reproductive success, because again, this isn't a longitudinal study. And what we see here is that settled mothers are actually have a much higher fertility than their mortality. So this bar has decreased in size now, but they're still having an additional 0.59 surviving offspring given their age compared to most nomadic women. And what's interesting, we have this variable here, which is mobile in the sedentarized camp. And this is, as it describes, there's some women who would be living in these big camps, but they would be moving in and out of the big camps. So they would seem to have the negative effects of living in these permanent camps and the positive effects and the negative effects of decreased fertility. And that's because the fertility was primarily correlated with the women's movement in and out of camps rather than the degree of sedentarization. So when people talk about transition to agriculture or sedentarization, this is a lot of different measures being wrapped into one term. You have what the people are doing and where they live. And arguably, it seems to be that BMI and fertility are related to how the mother moves, and the diseases are all about the environment, which makes sense. And so this is why they ultimately seem to be getting the worst part of the deal. So why do something unhealthy, and why settle? Well, for the actor, we've demonstrated that it might be that there's an increase in extrinsic risk because there's higher viral disease load. And parasitic load, and when this happens, it may be an adaptive strategy to start focusing energy on having a lot of children rather than having a few and investing a lot more in them. And this is maybe why we see there tends to be trends with the onset of settlement and cultivation for increases in fertility. And then we see the rapid population growth, which was denoted in the Neolithic Revolution. And to say that, obviously, the Agta or many hunter-gatherers like the Agta are quite a vulnerable population. They live in some of the lowest income countries around the world, and they've been referred to as fourth world peoples because they have not the same rights and obligation, voice and position in society to actually support their case. They're a minority within minorities. So conducting this kind of research has, I think, ethical considerations beyond just getting ethical approval. And just to say that this is part of a bigger project, which I continue to work on with Andrea Migliano, about working with the Agta to understand how can we better improve their health and their outcomes and allow them to decide how they want to do with their life, what they want to do with their life, because the health services and the government in the Philippines promote sedentarization, and of course what we find is that sedentarization actually has negative consequences because it's not done properly. And so it's all about setting up spaces in which dialogue can happen. Okay, so moving on to the next piece of research. I'm really interested in topics in cooperation and social networks, and ultimately how we can use these to better understand the trade-offs that parents make and they're looking after their children and how they decide to move on to the next birth. So these similar kind of reproductive decision-making. So humans have been argued to have a unique life history because we seem to miraculously combine having a lot of children with having very high quality children. So if we take a comparison against chimpanzees, our closest relative, you can see that the age of weaning in humans is 2.8 compared to 4.5. And because breastfeeding is one of the biggest predictors of interbirth interval, causing lactational amenorrhea, we can see that the interbirth interval is significantly shorter in humans compared to chimpanzees. And as a result, in natural fertility populations, we see total fertility rates around 7 to 8, compared about almost double that of chimpanzees. But what's interesting is we have, compared to mother, very large babies. They're very fat, and we all know how much a human child requires in terms of investment. So it's a big question of how we manage to combine both quantity and quality of offspring. And some have suggested that this can be answered in the humans' extensive cooperative breeding. I'm just bringing this up here because I don't know people's backgrounds, but there is a dizzying array of definitions of cooperative breeding in the literature, and that quote actually comes from a book which is just looking at non-human animals. So it's not even considering how us as anthropologists use this term. Strictly speaking, cooperative breeding is when there's a monopolization of breeding by one dominant female, which leads to the reproductive suppression of other females in the group. Meerkats is a good example. For instance, if a female in a meerkat troop, I don't know actually the name of the group of meerkats. Anyway, if she does reproduce, this could lead to the dominant female actually killing the offspring of the non-dominant females. In contrast, there's a lower you have the concept of communal breeding, in which you have lots of females reproducing at the same time and investing in each other's children or offspring. So arguably, I would say that humans are communal breeders rather than cooperative breeders, and that's why, just going on the talk, I'll be referring to communal breeding, even though the literature is commonly known as cooperative breeding hypothesis. So the literature argues that allo mothers are critical for the rearing of lots of high-quality offspring. In particular, we have very short interbirth intervals, so when a female can actually stop breastfeeding earlier and pass on a big proportion of the child rearing load to other caretakers. And this is because when there's allo care, or allo mothers, which is care from anyone who other than the mother is able to reduce her own energy expenditure and reinvest that in other activities. And it's interesting to note that it's absent in the non-human apes, but widely, cross-culturally, widely present in humans. So if you look at the anthropological literature, there is an early division between the importance of fathers and pair bonding and grandmothering. And I mention this because it seems to lead to a really focus in the literature looking at the importance of kin in communal breeding. So some people, particularly researchers, are working in South American groups, argue that males have a much more productive hunting rate, they have a much higher calorific contribution, and they're the ones supporting mothers and children because mothers can't forage to the same efficiency when they're pregnant and or with a newborn. And then we see the Hadza work demonstrating that actually because hunting is very unreliable, it's grandmothers who are producing a lot of the resources. There has been a big meta-analysis by Sierra Mace back in 2008, generally finding that in every society they looked at, there's always someone which is important other than the parents for looking after the child, sorry, other than the mother, but who that person is just varies. So one kin is always important. But what I found really interesting, if we look at the distribution of individuals who live in hunter and gatherer camps, we're living with a lot of unrelated individuals. So this is a pie chart of who lives in an active camp. But if you look at the same one for a number of different hunter and gatherer communities, it has a very similar distribution. And what we see is that 25% of the camp are with your close or distant kin. And then because of pair bonding, you have 25%, which are your close or distant, close affines. And then you have basically no relationship or very distant affinal relationships. And if we just think about this in terms of communal breeding, it means that many of the people you are residing with and will be looking after a child might not actually be a relative. And also, if we think more broadly than this, it's not always about the interaction between, for instance, a grandmother and a child, but it can be more about what's the relationship between C and D, and how would that affect A, because we live in these more complex lives with these big unrelated groups. And this is why I think social network analysis is really interesting, because it lets us look at the emergent properties of group and looking beyond just necessarily dyadic relationships. So I just gave a bit of terminology because there's a lot of terminology and I'll try and keep this as simple as possible, but if anything is confusing, just please ask me. So your importance in your network is called your centrality. As you can imagine, you could understand that to be if you were in a central position. So this is a very classic example. You see these two yellow nodes here, and nodes is the individual that you're looking at, are connected to the most other individuals in this social network. So they would be argued to have a high degree centrality. So you have a lot of connections. But there are a lot of different ways of measuring centrality. And what I think the most interesting is there's direct measures, like having a lot of connections, and there's indirect measures, which I will just talk about now. So in this paper I'll present, we used a lot of different measures, which is quite common. They all mean slight variances on a very similar thing. So I'm just going to talk about the ones which are necessary for the results, but if you have any questions or you're interested, please ask me. So degree, I just described it. In the grey node here is ego, and they have one degree because they're only connected to one person. In contrast, this one here has a higher degree because they're directly connected to four people. But then, more interestingly for me, is the concept of indirect ties. So this is, how does C and D affect A, for instance? This is the concept of betweenness. So the grey ego here has a low betweenness, and that's because this bottom group has three pathways to connect this top group. So they do not have to go through the grey ego. In contrast, here, the two groups are only connected through the grey ego, so this can be understood as a broker or a bridge in the network, and somewhere what information or resources must be transferred down. Very similar concept is the one of closeness, which it represents the speed or the efficiency, i.e. the low distance between nodes. So on the left here, again, we have low closeness. So if this guy wants to connect with this guy, he'd have to go through two other individuals. In contrast, the high closeness in this one, because they are directly connected to different to all the individuals in the social network. So this means that betweenness and closeness are very closely related, which is important for our results because it's all about efficiency and independence within the network. Okay, hypothesis. Social network position influences fitness. Pretty broad. And what's interesting, there's quite a bit of research on this in behavioral ecology and in various different animal systems. And this was the first test, I think, as far as it's aware of, in human hunter and gatherer populations. So this is breaking down into three predictions. That centrality, a measure, don't know which measure, would be positively correlated with number of living offspring. Because hunter and gatherers live in very dense cooperative communities, we thought that perhaps the social network would be important to fitness via the route of cooperation. So can we see if there's any association between cooperation and social networks? And finally, trade-offs must occur because energy is finite. So this was the same Angus population which we studied before, a smaller subsample, as only about 200 actually wore the moats, which I'll talk about in a second, and we did the social network analysis with. But it also included a second population from the Hunter and Gatherer Resilience Project, which is the Bayaka, who are from Congo Brazzaville. So these are a forage hunter and gatherer community, one of the Central African picking groups. They primarily hunt meat and forage, and this is often traded for various resources. But like many hunter and gatherers, they are very mobile, they're very cooperative, and have been called fiercely egalitarian in the literature. So to measure social networks, we developed a thing called a moat, which gives us proximity networks. So which is literally who comes in contact with who, with whom. And these are wireless sensing devices, which that means they are able to create these ad hoc networks which aren't based on infrastructure. So for instance, if you wanted to have a measure of social network, a lot of the technological solutions may require there be some kind of Wi-Fi or power base or something like this to be finding out who is in contact with who. But what these do is demonstrated in this figure here. So they're these blue boxes which simply have a battery, a memory, and a board which sends out a signal. It sends out a signal every 2 minutes, but you can program the frequency of that. And it would be sent and received by all individuals within a 3 meter radius, which is again, you can control the distance it's sent and received by. And so in this diagram here, you see all the blue egos are in contact with each other. So every 2 minutes, if you remained in contact, that would be sent and received by the message, by the motes. And in contrast, they're not overlapping with the purple group, who would be a separate contact network. And then this orange guy would be like overlapping the two groups. And so 200 individuals in 6 camps wore them on their armbands, and these were sealed, so they couldn't remove them, and they were wrapped and waterproofed, so they didn't die with the frequent fishing. These created our measures of centrality, which is standardized per camp, so it would be if you are high or low compared to your campmates. And we also used these to draw up the number of maternal interactions with kin and non-kin to get at a proxy of communal breeding. So just like before, we interviewed a number of mothers, 39 Agus mothers, 38 Bayaka mothers, to get a sense of fertility, mortalities, and survivorship to age 16. And again, to control for the fact that it's not longitudinal, these are age-specific residuals. And then just in the ACTA only, I continued this study to do a medical survey with a trained health professional. So we're working with a local doctor who drew up a questionnaire of a series of symptoms that he may have had in the last 2 weeks. And then that was returned to the doctor, who would, based on this symptom list, would describe, would diagnose if they had a certain disease or not. Generally a respiratory tract infection, diarrhea, parasites, for instance. And then this is just created into a summed up variable of ranging between, I think, 1 and 4, the number of disorders you had in the last 2 weeks. And then also used, obviously, the data from the red blood cell counts, looking at hemoglobin levels and BMI, to look at child outcomes based on this. So moving on to results. The first thing I think is really interesting is there's remarkable similarity between our two field sites. Me and the colleague Nick, who was the lead in BIACA, were surprised just about how similar these came out. Really surprised, in fact. So on the y-axis, we have the number of living offspring, which is survivorship to age 16. And on the bottom, we have the standardized maternal centrality. At the top is the ACTA, and then the bottom is the BIACA. The green bar is closeness, and the blue bar is betweenness. So the ones which have a brighter color are the ones which are significant, so with 95% confidence intervals. And then the pink bar is degree. So we can see is that both betweenness and closeness are positively correlated with the number of living children, whilst degree is negatively correlated, which is significant in the ACTA, but not in the BIACA. So centrality, as I mentioned, measures can often mean very similar things, and they often are highly correlated, which is why you don't tend to put them all into the same model. And we did a correlation plot looking, so it hasn't come up very well, but this is betweenness, this is closeness, and this is degree. So we're just looking at the top half of the correlation plot. So the stronger the colour, the closer the relationship, and they have significance values on it, which is less than 0.001 on two of them, and 0.03 on that one. And what that shows is that betweenness and closeness are very, very similar measures. And as a result, I'm going to focus on betweenness for the rest of the results, even though they hold if you run it with closeness. It's just to save you from millions of plots. And then also you can see that there's a negative correlation with degree for both of them. So if you run multivariable models with both closeness, betweenness, and degree, we find that degree drops out. It's no longer a significant predictor. So again, this is why I focus on betweenness, because I think degree is just perhaps the opposite, not exactly the opposite of betweenness, but it's capturing something very similar to the negative of betweenness. So what's the mechanism? Then this is thinking about the cooperation prediction. So what we did is ran a multi-level model controlling for household and camp residents, and looking at if maternal betweenness predicted the number of kin or non-kin interactions that she had. This at the moment is, this isn't actually in the paper, it's an exploratory analysis which I'm developing at the moment, and it will get more refined. Particularly I want to do this analysis with actual, I'm just currently doing data processing, but actual childcare observations, so we actually know if the non-kin are involved in childcare. What we see is that mothers are with higher betweenness have much more interactions with non-kin, and that's non-significant with kin. And I think this is really interesting in the hunter and gatherer context, which I'll explain just in a second. So we do see there's trade-offs in child well-being. So children who are more between children who have mothers who are more between perform worse on these nutritional markers. So on the top plot, we have hemoglobin level of the child, and on the x-axis, we have maternal centrality in both of them. And what we see here is this is degree, the blue line, and you can see that mothers with higher betweenness centrality tend to have children with lower hemoglobin levels, and under 110 would be defined as anemic, so you can see that's pulling quite a number of children down. And similarly, we can see child BMI, which is standardised for the average BMI of their age within the own population Z-scores, not compared to the WHO Z-scores. We can see, again, there seems to be a trend of mothers with more mothers paired between us having children with lower BMI Z-scores. And this isn't wholly sibling competition, obviously, because mothers with more between us have more children, so you might expect the children to be worse off. So we controlled for the number of older and younger siblings in these models, and still these effects remain. And it may be, if the non-kin are, if more interactions with non-kin mean that there's more non-kin doing your childcare, for instance, perhaps it's of lower quality. So mothers are trading off in that sense, but I'm a bit hesitant to say that without actually any measure of cooperation at the moment. So it'd be really interesting to get at what are these mediating factors, because there seems to be something here, but between us isn't actually a thing, it's just predicting a thing. So how can we use this to better understand the realities? And finally, we also find that between us, there's a trade-off in maternal well-being, as between us is negatively predicting the incidence of sickness that the mother reports in that last two-week period. And this is, again, controlling for family size, because normally women with more children tend to be sicker. So we can see here that mothers with higher centrality tend to have a very strong relationship with the number of reported sicknesses. And this is quite common in the epidemiological literature. If you're a broker in the network, then you're more likely to host the network because a lot of that transmission is coming through you. And, you know, so it seems that there may be a trade-off between this kind of central positions, which might be quite useful for cooperation or for sociality, for instance, but then will have negative consequences for disease, which always makes sense. It's like, you know, you get disease from other people. I say sniffing, sorry. So just moving on to the discussion, how do we, because these are quite abstract ideas, and how can we make sense of them in the Hunter and Gavro context? And particularly, how can we relate these our concepts of centrality, betweenness and closeness to access to non-kin? So this is a very classic social network of the Hunter and Gavro camp. This is one of them in the Philippines. And the red ties are your kin and the blue ties are your non-kin. And the thickness of the line is the weight, so how many times you have these interactions. And then they're clustered into these households. And you see that there's a few households which are very related and then some which are less related. And this does structure the interactions. This is a very good example of a small world network. And this is specifically the concept of, if you have everyone in a room sitting in a circle and everyone's connected to everyone and you had to go step by step, this is not very efficient. What is efficient is these big sweeping lines which join up the disparate groups in the network. And what you can see is that this line here is a very good example of this because it's a non-kin line. So in a separate publication, we found that the most efficient networks were the ones defined by these very strong non-kin ties. So it's your access, it's your interactions with non-kin which makes information or whatever resource transmit quicker throughout the network. And this kind of makes sense in a Hunter and Gavro context, and linking this back with the closeness and betweenness ideas. So if you are relying on a variable hunting or foraging ecology, there may be times that you're not successful, you don't have very high returns, so your household is going to be deficient, you have to spend longer hunting, so then you have less time to look after your children. It would be quite hard then if you had all your interactions, just all your cooperative interactions just within your household or your kind of cluster of households which are closely related. What might be more useful as a time in need is to be able to go across the network and find someone who perhaps isn't having such a hard time. So arguably then maybe it's access to non-kin which would be more important in these kind of highly variable foraging ecologies. And there'd be important sources of cooperation. Now, of course, as I said, I haven't tested haven't made the step yet to test if this is cooperation, but that's the next step in the process. I have 80 children that I observed for 9 hours, each totaling about 180 every 30 seconds. So it's a ridiculous number of observations, and which all unfortunately use data inputs. I didn't take an iPad to the field, which would have saved me so much time. But once that's done, we can actually start using that data to look at who is actually helping who, rather than just who is in contact with who, which are slightly different things, even though you often have been in contact to help. So moving back to parental investment and quantity quality trade-offs, I'm really interested in the idea that the cooperative breeding literature often assumes that there'll be a positive outcome on a child if there are more allocarers, for instance. That's because they think, you know, if a grandmother was to help, then the child would be better off because the mother has more energy. But actually, a mother can decide what she does with her energy, which would be dependent on the environment. So going back to this concept of extrinsic risk. So if you suddenly have an extra 200 calories, if we were going to boil it down to calories, available in a day, you may decide just to invest that in your own soma and increase the likelihood of or speeding up the next reproductive event. And you may not actually reinvest that into your children's quality. And again, thinking about the previous study, if we go back thinking about the high disease, high mortality the eggs live in, it maybe makes more sense if with cooperative breeding, communal breeding in the ecta, that they actually are having more children rather than having less high quality ones, and maybe that's what's coming out with the cooperative breeding stuff. And again, that's something which I'll be expanding with the next data set. Am I doing okay for time?
10 minutes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, I'll just go for this quickly. So this is all looking at sex bias parental investment. Sure, many of you are aware that in a sexually reproductive and reproducing species, an evolutionary stable strategy is to have a 50-50 sex ratio. And that's because if you have too many males in a population, women start having more children, it will slowly balance up because the selective advantage of having females will be eventually balanced when they have, as soon as there's too many women in the population, and it'll drop down again. But, of course, if we look worldwide and in a number of hunter and gatherer ecologist communities, sex ratios are not balanced. So this blue bar is a female bias sex ratio. All the orange bars are male bias sex ratios. And this is from Hewlett's paper in 1981, which is a review of about 18 different foraging populations. And these are all just the ones which are most closely relatable to the ecta. So a high sex ratio is when it's more male biased, and that's when it's over 100. So if you have, for instance, 112, that means you have 112 males to 100 females, which is, and 100 would be the 50-50 ratio. So worldwide, we see on average a sex ratio of about 105 to 107. And so it's known to be a common trend and leads many, if you hunt people looking at working with hunter and gatherers and horticultural populations, you know, what is the reason for this male bias? And we wanted to explore both the functional and mechanistic reason why the ecta actually have a very male biased population of 120 males to 100 females. So the question is, why are there more males? There could be a behavioural mechanism at play. So males increase parental fitness of being more helpful. Again, as we talked about before, males having a higher calorific return rate with hunting, and that's been argued to be associated with female infanticide. So males have been argued to increase the relative fitness of kin. So the inclusive fitness of parents is increased if they have more males because males are more helpful. But, of course, that's coming from a whole bunch of literature that primarily work with males hunting in the Amazon rainforest. If we look at a lot of female-dominated literature, which is just always an interesting division, you can see there's importance of communal breeding and its female sisters, the concept of helpers in the nest, which is also in the avian literature and in a wide range of mammalian literature, to be the ones to be seen as more important. But so what I'm trying to say is who is more cooperative or more helpful really depends on how you define help. It could be either of these two, or it could be many other features, characteristics. And as far as I know, no one has really worked out what sex, has done a paper demonstrating that males, there's more males because they actually are more helpful. But they argue often if you do see high sex ratios in the literature, it's often assumed to be a product of excessive female death. And that's either through infanticide or sex-selective neglect. So this is really well documented in large-scale societies, I'm sure we're aware of the examples, and also in some non-egalitarian forages. So these ones with hierarchical social systems, normally sedentarization, quite lush environments, examples of the Inuit, the reservation Ashe, some Aboriginal groups, and the Kuva. But what we find is it's ethnographically rare in the egalitarian foragers. So with the ecta, I've never heard it reported. I've spoken to other researchers who worked with similar ags populations and never heard about it. And also, you know, these are generally egalitarian and sex egalitarian societies. So it'd be quite unusual to see a bias in sex investment when there's not wealth or inheritance happening, which are the more classic examples of this behaviour. So based on this, the fact that I knew that what I never witnessed or heard of infanticide in the actor, I was very dubious of the behavioural mechanisms such as infanticide or female bias neglect. And it led me to wonder whether this was a biological mechanism. So are more males being born because more males die? Or is it an extension of Fisher's balanced sex ratio work? So if there is consistently higher mortality of one sex before the end of parental investment, it means that one sex is significantly less costly because they haven't technically received their full quota of parental investment. So parental investment is equalised in this sense by producing more of the higher mortality sex. And this is why the sex ratio on average is about 106 worldwide, because males do tend to be more vulnerable to death for intrinsic reasons, and also extrinsic things like warfare, violence, and crime and whatnot. So this kind of implies, though, then is there a biological mechanism? And the literature is very sparse on this, but there's this interesting publication from the Japanese tsunami in 2011. And obviously this was a unique stressful event, which was a very, it produced a perfect place to conduct this study. And what they found was there was a sudden decrease in the number of males being born through two mechanisms which were occurring in utero. So it was sex-selective contraception implantation against the males, and then an increased incidence of the spontaneous abortions of the males. And this was generally argued to be fulfilling a Trefeld-Woodard hypothesis that in a bad environment which lacked resources, it's better to have females than males. So this kind of suggests that humans are capable of these biological mechanisms, and we don't need to revert to to infanticide to explain highly biased sex ratios. So this is with work of Sarah, by the way, who I think is giving you a talk next week. So what we thought was like, well, first, what would we actually expect these different mechanisms to look like across age cohorts? So the male biased at birth hypothesis is that you have a lot of males born right at the beginning because, you know, as time goes on, they're all dying off, and eventually if you let them carry on, they'd go equal. So this is over 15 population years, and then this dotted line at the bottom is a balanced sex ratio. And the actual sex ratio here was important because this is just a hypothetical visualization of the trends. And on these three here, this is when the sex ratio is balanced at the beginning. And then we have the orange line, which is female infanticide and neglect. You can see very quickly there's a sharp peak because females are dying. And then it drops down a little bit, and then ultimately it keeps on going because there is neglect. And then there's also the example of just infanticide, which is the blue one, and then just neglect, which is the most slowly increasing sex ratio. So what we thought is it would be very interesting to look at the cohort data for the actor to see, you know, how do they match these trends? And because we hypothesised that the sex ratio in the actor was biased because of male-biased extrinsic mortality, not selective female mortality. So this leads to three predictions: that the sex ratio will decrease over childhood, like the yellow line, not increase. There's no evidence of female neglect from the childcare observations. So I've managed to get half of my sample input, about 35. So this is looking at 35 children who were focal followed. And then childhood mortality, 0 to 16 years, is male, not female biased. So I'll just explain, sorry, it's a bit wonky. I'll just explain this plot to you. So this is the different age cohorts of the actor. It starts as proportion of males and females, so it starts off at 0 and goes to 100. The dashed line in the middle is 50, and we start off with witness births. It's because, obviously, this wasn't a longitudinal study. We never got we don't actually have a true at-birth sex ratio because people just reported to us. But what happened because I was in the field for 2 years is I was aware of 16 women who were pregnant, and then I was there for them to give birth. So we can say with confidence that that was without any infanticide or neglect. And this is subset because it's a part of the under one cohort. And we can see that the sex ratio for the witness to birth is about 300, and it goes for the under ones, it's 200, and it goes down to about 130, my eyes, and then, yeah, 130, 115, 95, and then for the rest of the reproductive age group, it's basically even. And running regression analysis and chi-squared, we see that there's a gradual change in the difference of the sex ratio between the cohorts, as these two groups are the ones which are significantly different. No other comparison was significantly different to each other. So this indicates that the trend is much closer to the yellow line we saw before with male bias at birth than, and it's not painting a picture of female infanticide or neglect because it's not increasing. Obviously, these peak at the end, this is a very small sample, so that's not significant, and I have no idea why that one is peaking, but as we're not interested in the post-reproductive lifespan. So, do we see any difference in amount of parental investment in children? So this is the data from the 35 children aged 0 to 6 years who I focal followed. So every 30 seconds you make observation of all high and low investments. And then we explored if there was any difference between both parents, between mothers, did they invest less, fathers invest less, or both mothers and fathers. And each of these plot, the green is the males and the yellow is the females, and the significance values are on the top. But you can see that the basically males and females are treated the same, regardless of their sex. And in fact, there does seem to be a trend that females receive slightly more investment, particularly if you look just at fathers. But it becomes a very small sample because males actually don't invest that much in the children anyway. But in short, we don't see that there's any female neglect. And we also did run analysis looking at just households which just had sons and daughters, which was a small sample, about 15, because it's getting enough sons and daughters into the under six category. And again, we see no difference if we just look at households with both. So that means we have no support for the female biased neglect or infanticide hypothesis. And then we looked at the mortality data from the reproductive histories of the mothers, and what we find that males are more likely to die. So this is the month survived. So we did up to age 16, so about 196 months, I think. And then this is a cumulative hazard of death, so each month added on to another. And what we see by age 16, males have a 35% cumulative hazard of death compared to females who only have a 20% cumulative hazard of death, which is 56% higher. And this is when offspring we're controlling for mother and camp effects in this analysis, and also controlled for age of birth, to come for obviously any temporal effects. And also, it's just interesting to note that actually the main difference, significant differences, are happening in extrinsic risk. So this is forms of death which are accidents, violence, or alcohol related. This is a smaller sample of 155 deaths, just because we have accurate reporting for those deaths, where we're sure about the cause of death. And you can see that it's actually the sex ratio of 850 for, I think, approximately the 20 children that died from accidental causes of death. So, just to conclude this section, I think what we've demonstrated is there's no evidence of biased parental investment, which we really did expect given the nature of a hunter-gatherer society. We found that mortality risk is male-biased rather than, and it's extrinsic, and mothers are adaptively adjusting their sex ratios at birth to equalise parental investment. And human sex ratios at birth can be influenced by differential mortality. And you know, as I've discussed before, there's an important concept of finite resources and extrinsic risk here. But given that mothers may not be able to positively influence the child outcome if a lot of the deaths are extrinsic, like accidental, you know, a drowning in a typhoon or things like this, then that's why it starts to be more likely to having more males rather than investing, wasting your investment in a child that's going to die. Anyway, so this is just the last slide. Parents have limited resources, which we are in human behavior ecology predicting will be influencing their lifetime fitness. And there's a lot of theory to believe this should be the influence by extrinsic risk, and the lines of evidence that I'm working with at the moment seem to also suggest this. But these ideas are all quite, I don't want to say wish-washy, but they're all quite hard to define. I think disease is extrinsic risk in the ag test, so I've called it as such. But really, there's very few studies out there which are really capturing what is extrinsic risk, what is intrinsic, how are they different, and how does this better help us to understand variation in parental investment? And this is how I want to take this work further in the future, really developing, rather than using proxies of extrinsic risk, you know, start developing a framework which can be operated for other disciplines and be useful beyond human behavioural ecology. So that's it really, that's my plea for the future. So just leave me to say thank you to all my co-authors, Sarah Myers, who worked with the sex ratio paper, and you'll hear from this week, and then Mark Dan-Smith and Sylvain Vigui, who are due to the data collection, my supervisors and mentor, Rebecca Sear at the London School of Hygiene, and then my funding from Lieberhum and the MRC, and then of course the ACT-UP, you know, I wouldn't be anywhere without them. So that's it. And thank you for listening.